morning is Kunz against DeFelice. Mr. Thompson.
May it please the court. Plaintiff's credibility, truthfulness, bias, and memory are central to any determination of liability and punitive damages against DeFelice. The subsequent failure to allow the jury to consider all evidence relative to the plaintiff's credibility, truthfulness, and bias resulted in prejudice to the defendant, DeFelice.
Mr. Thompson, you may think these are vital issues. We think that knowing why the district court did what it did is a vital issue. And, of course, your brief fails to comply with Circuit Rule 30, which requires you to include in an appendix the district court's explanation for its decisions. The plaintiffs say that the district court's explanations haven't even been transcribed, let alone provided. Is that true?
I concede, Your Honor, that there was some issues with respect to what was
on
the record.
I don't see why we shouldn't just summarily dismiss this appeal. We can't resolve it without seeing the district court's reasons.
Well, there was sufficient reasons in the record, perhaps not all of the reasons, but sufficient reasons to present these arguments to the court.
You do know that we have quite a number of cases saying that in a civil case, if a party fails to get the district court's reasons transcribed and provided, that the normal remedy is to dismiss the appeal.
I understand that, Your Honor.
So why should we not follow our circuit's normal law?
Well, there was sufficient findings and opinions by the trial court that were contained within the record that was just transcribed that is part of the record in this matter.
Your brief is completely empty. It contains no reasoning by the district court whatsoever.
Well, for instance, the court provided reasoning as to why it ruled about the disallowance of all of the convictions into the trial or evidence in this matter. And that was contained within the record, and the court provided its opinion as to why it disallowed all of the convictions into the record. It provided a basis for its opinions relative to why it was not going to allow the issue of drug consumption into evidence in the case, which was contained in the record. Perhaps it didn't provide all of the court's reasonings. It provided
these are to be found in the appendix to your brief. Where?
Well, for instance, the court's ruling relative to the record that Mr. O'Donnell lacks sufficient evidence to reach its conclusion as to the effects of drug use on memory or recollection. And it did contain in the record relative to the court's.
Hear my question. These are to be found where in the appendix to your brief?
Well, for instance, A19 was relative to the Rule 59 motion, which was the subject of the remitter on punitive damages.
You aren't even appealing. Your appeal concerns evidentiary rulings.
Well, part of our appeal does include the issue of the remitter, that it was still insufficient.
That's not how you phrased it, though, in your brief. Point 5 of your opening brief says that it's going to talk about prejudice from the dismissal of the various other defendant police officers. Now, I will grant you that in the text of that section of the brief, you kind of go off and talk about whether the punitive damage award was excessive, but you don't signal that as an issue that you're raising on appeal.
There are five. You list five issues for appeal. The amount of damages is not included in your issues for appeal. But in any event, not related to my question. I mean, I take it that you agree that none of the district court's rulings with respect to any of the five issues that are listed as your issues for appeal is in the appendix. And I don't think that any of them is even transcribed, but maybe the second point is wrong.
Well, that's correct. With respect to that specific point, it's not contained in the appendix. All of the court's rulings and opinions are contained within the transcription of the record itself.
The plaintiffs say that you did not order transcripts of these portions of the record. Is that true or false?
That's not correct. I ordered transcripts of all of the proceedings in this matter. And it was an effort to get all of those transcripts, but we did obtain all of the transcripts relative to the trial in this matter and submitted that as...
Is some reason why you didn't bother to address this issue in your reply brief?
Well, there wasn't anything more that I could supply to the court other than the transcripts of the court's findings and opinions.
The word transcript doesn't appear in your reply brief. The word transcribed doesn't appear in your reply brief. Right? The plaintiffs say that these portions are not transcribed. If, in fact, that's false, if they were, we expect you to tell us that they have been and where we can find them. Your reply brief is silent on that question. That's why I assumed that the plaintiffs were correct.
Just so I understand, I'm clear in response to that question, there was no omission deliberately or otherwise relative to any transcriptions of any of the proceedings relative to the underlying matter.
Right.
They were all obtained, and they were all provided as part of the record in this matter. There is no further record that is not before the court that's in anybody's possession. So we tendered all of the record and the opinions contained within the record that were made relative to this underlying matter.
Well, there are really two questions here. One of them is, I mean, all I can understand from this is that maybe for some reason that I don't understand, Judge Zagel didn't have some things recorded somehow by the court reporter. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I take from this. But then we get back to the fact that our circuit rules do require parties to include in the bound appendix with the brief the text of whatever parts of the district court's rulings you wish to complain about, because it's a convenience to the judges. We need to see what did the district court do, and it's as far as it goes, it's fine that it's there somewhere in the record, but the circuit rule does specifically say, the Federal Rules of Appellate mm-hmm. Procedure and the circuit rule says, as to those things, you have to bind them with the brief. Then, for other sorts of things, you can put them in a separately bound appendix. But it's quite difficult for us to know, you know, let's take any of your points, you know, the district judge's decision about the drug use or the district judge's decision about this alleged expert or any of these things.
It's quite difficult for us to do anything because you also certified that you'd complied with the court rule. So the very first thing that snaps off this brief is that you're lying to the court. And it's not clear to me why we shouldn't assume that everything else is untrue.
Well, the cites within the brief are cites to the opinions and decisions found within the record, but it is not a cite to the record that's part of the appendix. That is true.
Well, if we were to move beyond this, and I'm not sure that we can, but your other problem, I think, is that the kinds of arguments that you're raising are all questions that fall within the discretion of the district court, and the district court we don't presume district courts make mistakes. You know, we need to be shown that the district court did something wrong, and so a lack of information isn't going to help you on the merits either. I mean, these are abuse of discretion standards. One can imagine why the judge might have thought that there was reason to control the trial in certain ways with the kinds of evidence he was letting in or not letting in.
I certainly appreciate that, and that is the theme of the brief, is that there was an abuse of discretion on issues where the court didn't have discretion to exercise. For instance, the plaintiff being the only be-all witness, his truth and credibility is the central issue. There is no provision that allows a felony conviction not to be admitted into evidence.
Certainly there is. I mean, 609A1 refers explicitly to Rule 403. The district judge might have thought that there was lots of evidence in. He might have thought that what you wanted was cumulative. He might have thought all manner of things. And given the fact that there is no ironclad absolute rule in this respect, why shouldn't we assume the district judge knew what he was doing?
Well, for instance, from the outset, Rule 403 deals with cumulative evidence. We're only talking about three convictions.
But the cumulative evidence as to what? As to the question whether Mr. Coons was a person with a very sketchy background that maybe the jury shouldn't believe? There was lots of evidence in this trial about that. The jury knew that Mr. Coons was not going to get good citizen of the year.
Well, but the fact of the matter with the convictions is the convictions that were admitted were convictions that occurred prior to the incident.
The jury heard all sorts of things about the incident. This is a guy who sideswipes somebody's car, who drinks beer, who's taken drugs, who's done all kinds of things. I don't know why the jury, why a rational district court judge couldn't have said, enough is enough, let's move on.
Well, for instance, the defendant in this case is unique because the defendant is the law enforcement agency. The law enforcement agency.
That's not unique. We see tons of cases brought against the Chicago Police Department, Chicago police officers.
And the Chicago Police Department is also the arresting agency of the conviction that occurred after the incident.
I don't understand why that's unique.
After the complaint was filed. Because the perception is that the plaintiff made one dishonest act prior to the incident, but otherwise is not a dishonest person. And the jury was not aware of the fact that not only did the plaintiff commit a subsequent act of dishonesty, a subsequent felony, but that also that conduct occurred after the time that the plaintiff filed a complaint against the very law enforcement agency that was the agency that subsequently arrested him on the third conviction, which goes right to bias. It goes right to truthfulness. There's a host of reasons now why the plaintiff has a motive or bias now to lie about who, in fact, was responsible for the maltreatment.
But again, Mr. Thompson, if Judge Zagel had, for whatever reason, explained on the record, decided that he wanted to admit this several years later shoplifting, I'm not sure that would have been an abuse of discretion either. That's what discretion means. You might do one thing, you might do the other. There's a range of possible outcomes. But without knowing why he decided to keep that out, and certainly understanding that there was a lot of evidence before the jury that would tend to impeach Mr. Coons' credibility, it seems to me hypothetically possible that the judge thought that there was enough there.
The court, pursuant to Rule 41, allowed the dismissal of multiple defendants, since procedure is an issue, without any procedure followed relative to Rule 41.
Now, that no argument of yours mystifies me completely. I can't understand why the dismissal of these other defendants in any way impeded your ability to say it was their fault, not my client's.
Indeed, one would think it makes it easier. It's really easy to blame an empty chair. It's hard to blame somebody who can fight back.
Well, I think that's a disingenuous, it's an escape argument. The reality of it is...
I do not want to say that the court is disingenuous. That's not something that promotes an appellate advocate's arguments.
I apologize, Your Honor. What I'm trying to say is that there's only one face to the alleged maltreatment. The jury didn't come back and come to the conclusion that the maltreatment only occurred in the interview room. They came back with the conclusion that the maltreatment occurred in the parking lot and the interview room. And there was only one face left to that maltreatment, and that was DeFelice. So if it would have been unknown police officers in both instances, there would be no punitive damages award that could have possibly been entered. But since there was only one face, the whole bag of maltreatment was left on the lap of one defendant. The defendant had no time to prepare any other strategy. On the eve of trial, to walk in thinking it's all for one for all.
I don't comprehend that.
Well, they're sticking together.
Like
it didn't
Judge
happen.
Wood.
Pardon me?
I just don't understand it.
Well, an empty
Why
chair
don't you have a time to prepare as a good defense strategy from the beginning of the case the truth? Is it your point that the former strategy was not the truth and you're now throwing on some desire to come up with a new one?
Well, my point
is... The strategy is to provide the court with the truth all along. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that there's one lawyer representing seven defendants. And by the evidence in the case, the defendants that were dismissed are the only defendants that were identified as actually being in the interview room at any time.
Yeah.
They're the defendants that should stay in the case, not DeFelice, if anybody's going to get dismissed.
Were you that one lawyer, or were there other counsel?
I'm post-trial.
You're just post-trial.
Post-trial. There was one lawyer that represented the city, and there was one lawyer that represented seven police defendants. So, of course, it's in the best interest of the six defendants to get out of the case, but it's not in the best interest of your one remaining client to have those six defendants get out of the case. There's no shared liability or culpability anymore. Now you're stuck with an empty defense, a last-minute strategy, and one face to the alleged maltreatment left holding the bag for everybody. And that happens to be, coincidentally, the one police officer that was never identified as ever having any contact with the plaintiff or ever being in the interview room with the plaintiff at all. The only evidence
description, this was a godsend.
That what was a godsend?
Dismissal of the other six defendants, because it entitles your client to say, I had nothing to do with this. And the other defendants won't contradict him, because it's not in their interest.
You have to make an empty chair defense, and now you have one police officer blaming other police officers that were party of the case that aren't party anymore. That's not the strongest argument. The strongest argument is nobody did it. But if somebody did it, it's one of the seven of us, not just me.
I must say, an argument that nobody did it, implying that the plaintiff injured himself, is, I think, one that just would have gotten the damages even higher.
Well, I understand that, but in reality, that happens all the time. People get injured in lockup all the time. They get in fights back there. They hang themselves. They bang their faces against the jail cell doors. That happens all the time. And for instance, moving on to the drug consumption issue, there's ample evidence in the record that the plaintiff could have consumed and digested heroin at any time during the pursuit. And we were never allowed the opportunity to cross-examine the plaintiff on that. And that goes to his ability to recall the events in question. And what's important is the plaintiff himself puts the identity of the police officer who committed this maltreatment an issue from the very filing of the complaint. At the time they filed the complaint, the plaintiff knew.
What does the heroin have to do with this? Are you now making an argument that the district judge should have admitted the testimony of Mr. O'Donnell?
The trial court should have allowed the cross-examination of the plaintiff on heroin consumption, not just because it may or may not go to whether or not the plaintiff was maltreated, but more importantly, as with respect to Officer DeFelice, who it was that maltreated the plaintiff.
What does heroin have to do with physical injuries?
Well, I'm not challenging the fact that the plaintiff was physically injured. And I'm saying even if I can see...
What does heroin have to do with anything?
It goes to the ability of the plaintiff to recall or relect which
officer... That's why I thought you were now talking about O'Donnell, because that's what O'Donnell was going to testify. apparently, although there was never an offer of proof. And the district court concluded that O'Donnell is a bunkum artist, that there is no reason to believe this. So what's the problem with the district court's ruling? Well, as I understand it, I may not understand it correctly because I haven't seen it.
Well, I believe the district court said that there was no baseline for O'Donnell to rely upon, so there was no ability for him to cure that. So there's no reason to for any additional offer of proof because that was the issue. So what?
Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Mr. Levy.
May it please the court. My name is actually John Lovey, counsel. The district court did not commit trial errors, certainly didn't commit trial errors that would amount to an abuse of discretion, and certainly nothing that would have changed the outcome. There's no merit to the appeal at all. I'd like to break up my oral argument, talk briefly about the trial, and then move on to the cross-appeal, which presents, in our view, much more meritorious issues. As far as the circuit rule, it was violated, and that is enough to get rid of the appeal.
Well, I think your discussion of these matters can be extremely brief.
Fair enough, Your Honor. But to clarify, what was not transcribed was the ruling where the district court changed his mind and said this third...
Mr. Thompson said in front of us that everything has been transcribed.
What was neither side confined a transcription of is when the district court said that the third conviction wasn't coming in. It originally said he was going to let the third conviction in. There was further briefing, and then he said the third conviction is out. Nobody can find a reference to that. Whether it was transcribed or not, I don't know, but it's not in the record to plaintiff's knowledge. What also is not in the record is any place where the district court said, I am barring cross-examination about cognition and drugs, because the district court never said that. The district court said, O'Donnell can't prove it, but the district court never barred the defendants from doing the very thing that Mr. Thompson is alleging, that they were prejudicially denied the ability to do. There was no trial errors. The district court decision should be affirmed. Now, we are grateful that the jury awarded the damages that it did for the physical beating, but this case has always been about much more than that. A confession was coerced from a criminal defendant by means of violence, and as a result, Mr. Kuntz spent almost a year, if you credit our evidence, 2 months, if you credit their evidence, in jail, for a crime he didn't commit.
I must say, I have a lot of difficulty understanding the basis of this argument. He ultimately pleaded guilty to the drug charge and was sentenced to prison. And the whole period for which you're claiming damages appears, so far as I can tell, to be time that he spent in prison pursuant to that conviction. So how could he get damages for time he spent in prison on an unrelated conviction?
Well, Your Honor, had he been never charged with the PSMV, he never would have been in jail for that length of time. When he got convicted
he would have been in jail for a different period.
And that's exactly what was not the case, Your Honor. He was in jail longer than he would have been without the stolen car.
I just don't comprehend it. He was sentenced to time served, which means he was sentenced on the drug charge all the time he spent in prison. Now, if on the drug charge the judge had said, I sentence you to 6 months, you've already served more than 6 months, so you're released, then I could at least see that you had the basis, the makings of an argument. But the judge didn't say that. He said, I sentence you on the drug charge to all the time you've spent in prison.
But, Your Honor, I'm sorry to interrupt.
So every day he was in prison, he was serving a valid sentence unrelated to these events.
And that is that's looking from backwards forwards. And what the evidence in the record shows, Your Honor, is that had he never been charged with the PSMV, he would not have served that much time. So
are you essentially saying that this strikes me maybe as a backdoor way to say that the stolen motor vehicle charge, if you forgive me, I don't want to use all these initials because I get them confused.
Right. With the initials. I couldn't understand the briefs in this case. They're almost incomprehensible to somebody for whom things like CSMV is not English.
Stolen car.
All right. So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that had this confession never been beat out of him, had he never been charged with possession of a stolen motor vehicle, that charge wouldn't have been used to enhance his sentence on the drug charge, and without that enhancement, maybe it would have been the situation that Judge Easterbrook is talking about, that there only could have been a 6-month or 12-month sentence, not the longer sentence that he in fact got. Because somehow or another, you need to address the issue that Judge Easterbrook is talking about, namely, once you're sentenced for time served, that looks like that sentence now has to do with the drugs, not the stolen motor vehicle.
Well, and I think there is an answer. Had he never been charged with the stolen car, that's what the jury's got to be asked to look at. He was charged. One university was charged with the stolen car, and another university was never charged with the stolen car. In the universe where we could prove to a jury that absent the coerced confession, he would not have been charged with the stolen car, in that universe, he would not have spent that time in jail. Now, it is true he was ultimately sentenced to time served, but we are entitled to ask a jury, assume he had never been charged with the stolen car, if that had been the case.
I don't see how you can collaterally attack the drug sentence. That's part of the function of Heck, that you can't have a 1983 case that depends on the proposition that some sentence issued by a state court is incorrect or invalid too long unless that sentence has been set aside on collateral review.
I don't think
the argument you're now making is that you're sure your client would have gotten a lower sentence. There's something wrong with that sentence.
Well, for purposes of summary judgment, he would have gotten, had there never been a stolen car, the evidence in the record is the practice in that court, and when you're charged with a drug offense at that time, it would have been X. Now, it is true that because of the stolen car, he got 5X, and that they subsequently said, you're sentenced to time served. But in a pure causation framework, we're allowed to say, had he never been charged, he wouldn't have found it.
How is that consistent with Heck?
Well, Heck says you can't collaterally attack it, and we are not collaterally attacking
it. Heck says that you cannot take a position that is inconsistent with a judgment, with a state court's judgment, unless that judgment has been set aside. Your position seems to be inconsistent with the state court's judgment.
Well, the stolen car was used to enhance the sentence.
Well,
so you're reading of Heck.
File a collateral attack on the drug conviction and say that conviction should be set aside or it should be reduced because the sentence was enhanced based on an unconstitutional coerced confession. And then after that happens, under Heck, you would have some leeway. But until it happens, I can't see any leeway.
Again, we look at it as a causation thing.
Well, could I ask you maybe to look at it in a slightly different way? Because if you had some ground for arguing that you aren't attacking the underlying conviction on the drug charge, that is what it is, and thus that part of Heck isn't implicated, and if there is any authority for saying that Heck doesn't get to such a finely tuned level as how many months you're spending in prison, you acknowledge the state had the authority to do that. I don't frankly know whether you can squeeze that out of Heck, but it strikes me that that's what you would have to do in order to be able right now, this is reminding me of the movie Sliding Doors, you have the one universe in which everything happened as it did, and then the other universe in which he never confesses, and thus, according to at least what your proffered expert was willing to say, they wouldn't have assumed that the car was stolen because he had the keys, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the line of cases that the Supreme Court has developed under Heck would need to understand at a more precise level what happens if it's just a sentence enhancer, but you concede the conviction, you concede some sentence.
I agree, and we do concede the conviction.
But does Heck let you do that? I mean, Judge Easterbrook is suggesting that he reads it not to let you do that, and if that's the case, our hands are tied. If there is some legal route not discussed in your brief that wouldn't do that, then maybe it's different. I don't know.
Well, we look at it, you know, in the ex post way that he would not have been enhanced had it not been.
But does the Supreme Court let you do that under Heck and Edwards against Balasag and
right.
Wallace against Cato? And
take a simple situation. Defendant has two real convictions, conviction A and conviction B. Conviction A, his time has already been served. Conviction B, he's sentenced to 20 years with a recidivist enhancement because of conviction A. And he now files a 1983 suit saying conviction A is invalid it led to a longer sentence on conviction B, and I'm now entitled to damages for the additional length of the sentence on conviction B. And conviction B is still outstanding. Does Heck allow such a lawsuit?
My recollection of Heck is it talks about the conviction, not the sentence. And I think Judge Wood raises a proper question about it.
So would you answer my question? In your view, does Heck allow such a lawsuit?
Yes, Your Honor, it would.
And Mr. Levy, can I just ask you to go back to your two universes a second, where you talked about X and 5X. On time served, is it beyond X? In other words, I understand the enhancement occurred, but when time served was granted, are we in the framework of X?
No, we are beyond X, and there was a factual dispute as to whether we were 1 year beyond X or they argued 59 days beyond X. But he served more time than he would have had he been in this other universe where he was never charged. And it wasn't just the expert. We had DeFelice's own partner who said they don't go with it if you can't prove knowledge, if you got the keys, because otherwise we'd be in court with a felony stolen car every time somebody said I borrowed a car. So we do have a factual dispute here as to whether he would have been charged absent the confession. Now, we've been talking about the damages for detention. There are other damages here. There are punitive damages. Even if we concede the point raised by Judge Easterbrook, we have punitive damages, we have nominal damages, and we have emotional distress from the Gerstein hearing itself when he hears, I am having a coerced confession being introduced himself against himself. The Fifth Amendment says you can't be compelled to provide testimony against yourself. And Section 1983 says there is a tort remedy when that happens. One measure of damages, and obviously the most attractive from our perspective, is the damages that Judge Easterbrook has focused our attention on, whether we can get the extended detention. But there are other measures of damages as well, including nominal damages, punitive damages, and the emotional distress at the Gerstein hearing itself. So in essence, what we're talking about is a damages question, not a liability question.
And you would say those damages don't have the Heck problem because they don't involve any way of second-guessing the drug conviction.
Exactly.
And
they
sentence.
They don't attack that. So those damages are immune to the challenge that Judge Easterbrook has identified. And in our view, they have sidestepped that this is a violation of the Fifth Amendment. To beat a confession from somebody and then to use it in a criminal case is a constitutional violation. Sorenberger closes the loop, as does the case that counsel provided this court. If you use it in a Gerstein hearing, that is a constitutional violation. And this court has moved away from the Fourth Amendment as that remedy.
Yeah, and well, you see my problem. If you say the violation was the use of this confession in the sentencing hearing in the drug case, it seems to me you're right square in the middle of Heck.
Well, not necessarily just in the sentencing in the drug case, but when it was used against him at his initial Gerstein hearing. He showed up, and they told the judge he has confessed to this crime. Now, we can argue about what damages flow from that, but that is the use of a coerced confession. And not only is that unconstitutional, but it should be unconstitutional. We can't be telling police officers you can beat a confession out of somebody, use it at a Gerstein hearing, present it, and there are no damages, no nominal damages, no punitive damages, no emotional distress damages. There should be damages. And not only that, Your Honors, but we have the malicious prosecution claim. And that claim is viable as well.
And they're right. Of course, the city has argued that that all you have is the null pros, and you need more than that. I mean, the Illinois Supreme Court seems to me has not perhaps been pellucid, but it's you need some way of showing that matters were resolved favorably to him.
The way the Supreme Court put it of Illinois was, obviously a null is alone not enough, but what you have to show is that the abandonment, and they did abandon the charges against Kuntz, it is enough unless the circumstances of the abandonment are not indicative of innocence. So it's phrased in a way that's sort of favorable to the plaintiff, unless you can show, for example, that it was mercy or misconduct or an agreement with an accused, because they did abandon the prosecution.
Who has the burden of making that showing, in your view? Do you have to negate those things, or
the burden does remain with us because we are the plaintiff. But they did phrase the test in the negative. Because, you know, we have to show an abandonment. They did abandon it. It almost becomes an affirmative defense, because the way Swick talks about it is, unless the abandonment shows things like mercy or misconduct or an agreement, which are not present here. And we have a lot of factors why this is not just a nolle. For one thing, you know, you have the prosecutor's comments. We've hit a dead end. You have the judge's comments. They won't give up the discovery. They won't give up the OPS file. It has forced the state to change the election. You know, I take issue with counsel's characterization in our brief that we mischaracterized those transcripts. Those transcripts say exactly what we said they said. Hearing after hearing after hearing, the judge said to the state, where's the OPS file? Where is this evidence that the plaintiff's asking for that would allow him to prove a suppression? And at hearing after hearing, corporation counsel failed to show up. They kept telling the judge it was done. It wasn't done. They kept saying, we've got it to the court. They didn't get it to court. Finally, the state, despite having evidence that he was in a stolen car and a confession that he knew he was in a stolen car, the state said, never mind, we're not going to get this conviction. And why didn't they? Because they couldn't produce the evidence that would have allowed Mr. Kuntz to prove that his confession was not voluntary. You're never going to get a state's attorney to say, I dismissed it because he was innocent. It's a circumstantial inquiry. And here, we got plenty of circumstances, and we cited a lot of cases that it's ordinarily, you know, you can't get up there and just say I got nolled. But that's not what we showed here. We showed this was an extraordinarily unusual election to drop a serious felony in favor of a one-tenth of a gram drug conviction, and under the circumstances where they wouldn't give up the OPS file, which was exculpatory. So we should not have been told by the district court, you got neither remedy. You got no constitutional remedy. You know, there's a lot of jurisprudence in this court that if you don't have a constitutional remedy, go to state court. In this case, we have shown enough that the jury should have decided whether the circumstances, because it's a quintessential circumstantial inquiry, whether those circumstances were sufficiently indicative of innocence that you could show that the abandonment was for reasons other than innocence.
What should we infer from prosecutor's statement of a roadblock?
Well, you got to look at the circumstances. And what happened was, hearing after hearing after hearing, the defense attorney for Mr. Kuntz said, I'd like to make a motion to suppress this confession, and I need the OPS file. And the judge said, well, give him the OPS file. I'll sign whatever order you got to sign. And then hearing after hearing after hearing, the police department wouldn't give it up. And the judge kept saying, you know, I want somebody from Corporation Counsel Office to explain why they aren't giving me this file. And hearing after hearing, they didn't. And eventually, the judge said on the record, look, the problem has become so bad that they've changed the election. And in that file was a recommendation of 70 days of discipline for failure to provide medical attention to Mr. Kuntz. In that file was evidence that Mr. Kuntz did not resist and that there was no explanation for why his face looked like he got beaten to a pulp. Those are circumstances from which you could assume that the district court dismissed this for reasons other than innocence, because they had the tools to convict him. He was in a stolen car, and he confessed, and they nonetheless said, never mind. Now, with the permission of the court, I would like to reserve some of my time, because obviously the city is going to get to talk about these issues, and I would like an opportunity for rebuttal if the court would please the court.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Schultz.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I'll start with the causation element that's just been discussed at length. The theory of the plaintiff's case is always hinged on the idea that if he hadn't been charged with the stolen car crime, the possession of the stolen car, he would not have been held for as long as he had, and that charge depended upon the detention, the charge, and everything that followed depended upon the confession. But as it says on page 28 of his appendix, the district court expressly stated that the only testimony that he provided on that predicate issue of whether, absent his coerced confession, prosecutors would have pursued the PSMV charge, forgets the initials, and prevailed at Kuntz's arraignment, the only evidence that he provided after 5 years was the testimony of an expert. But the district court said, just as Andrews could not offer expert opinion as to the reason the prosecutors ultimately dropped the charge, he cannot opine as to the basis for their initial decision.
But I think he also has the district court may have written that, but he has circumstantial evidence that they do have the evidence they have. I mean, ordinarily, if there were, if you caught somebody red-handed in a car that was stolen and he confessed, yes, I knew the car was stolen and I was driving it and so on, you wouldn't imagine a prosecutor talking about we've hit a dead end. So we have on the record in the state court those things. Now, you don't have Andrews out and out saying, well, the what was going inside the prosecutor's mind was this, but surely this is something that has to be proven by circumstantial evidence.
Well, but the circumstantial evidence that's in the record, Your Honor, doesn't show that the state couldn't have succeeded on the charge.
Why does it compel a finding that the state would have gone forward? Don't we have a factual question? It seems to me you're going all the way over to the other extreme and saying, on the basis of this evidence, it's an open and shut case that there would have been both a prosecution and a conviction for the stolen motor vehicle, regardless of the confession. And I'm not sure that the record is that strong for you.
Well, although it is, causation is typically a proximate cause issue for a jury, not when there's no competent evidence offered, and Illinois law
shows...
Well,
but I'm asking you why the circumstantial evidence isn't there. You don't have the prosecutor standing up and saying in a deposition, the reason I dropped the stolen motor vehicle charge is because I knew it was never going to stick because the confession was going to be suppressed because it was beaten out of Mr. Coons. I mean, okay, that doesn't really surprise me that the prosecutor never said that. So there are other ways you get there, and I don't know that this record is as one-sided as you say.
Well, I take it that you're speaking of the malicious prosecution question now.
Yeah, you started there, so I thought...
Malicious prosecution is defeated by a probable cause, and there was at all times probable cause to believe that Mr. Coons knew that the car was stolen, because under the Illinois law that defines the offense, flight by itself, well, combined with the undisputed evidence here that he was in the car and that it was stolen, flight by itself constitutes sufficient evidence to convict. Therefore, by force of logic, it must be enough for probable cause. And malicious prosecution drops out if there's probable cause. There was probable cause at all times. In fact, we cite two Illinois cases. One is called People Against Gentry. That shows that the evidence in the arrest report alone, confession aside, was sufficient to convict for this particular charge.
So you think, let me pursue this for a minute. So you think that the existence of probable cause would trump my hypothetical statement by the prosecutor saying we dropped the stolen motor vehicle charges because we knew that Mr. Coons was innocent of that charge because he had no idea the vehicle was stolen, and that's an element that we would have to prove. Even though the prosecutor said that, you would say there's still no malicious prosecution claim?
Well, the presence of probable cause would defeat it.
So, okay, so even an out-and-out confession by the prosecutor, I know, we were prosecuting him, but he's innocent because he didn't have any idea. I now know that he had no idea.
As I understand it, yes, Your Honor, that the absence of probable cause is an element of malicious prosecution under Illinois law. So if there's probable cause, then the claim fails. But on top of that, I might add that the record... We do appear to be in something of a dispute about what the record says about the statements by the officers, but what happened was that Mr. Coons had a high school age co-defendant in the PCS case.
Was such a silly argument, actually. It seemed to me that if somebody is concerned about this co-defendant, to my knowledge, Illinois has the same tools for holding separate trials and severing cases as every other jurisdiction, and suddenly to start worrying about this high school co-defendant, as far as I was concerned, weakened your argument, didn't strengthen it.
Well, that was the reason stated for why the...
I know, and if you state a preposterous reason for something, then it doesn't tend to create confidence.
As far as the statements that were in the OPS file, one thing that we note is that this is characterized as, the plaintiffs say that we're misrepresenting the record when we say this, but the district court, Judge Zagel, granted summary judgment on the conspiracy claim against Goldston, largely because he found that Goldston, who had the OPS files, had no exculpatory evidence. The plaintiffs say that's wrong, but the order, which is 63 in the docket, says, Coons alleges that Goldston had exculpatory evidence in his possession, that an officer used physical force to coerce Coons to confess and bury the this evidence in his investigative file. The extent of Kuntz's proof is his assertion that Goldson had witness statements indicating that, and he goes on and says, this allegation is nothing more than conjecture and speculation, not supported in the record. Goldston had no concrete evidence that Kuntz had been coerced into confessing theft of the automobile.
This is yet another order that hasn't been attached to the briefs.
Correct. And goes on to say, Kuntz has failed to demonstrate how the evidence Goldston did discover as a result of his investigation was even arguably exculpatory.
Well, what came out of the file was both before the district court and before this court. We're capable of seeing if it's
fair
exculpatory
enough.
In the sense that that term's normally
It's also
used.
True that the representations of what the officer's statements say, we have a footnote in our brief explaining that those representations are misstated in the plaintiff's opening brief, and in his reply brief there are also several misstatements about what the officers actually said, what the OPS file actually said. But again, those statements are on page 27 of the reply.
What's your view on the real essence of Mr. Lobey's argument, namely that there is a right to recover, his other argument, a right to recover under the Fifth Amendment when a police officer... Well, let's put it this way. When someone is compelled to be a witness against himself for purposes of a Gerstein hearing because the police officer beat a confession out of him, that's coercion, right, beating?
We don't really contest that it's possible to recover under such a theory, that the plaintiff would have to show that the confession was coerced, that the officer caused it to be used, and that it caused some damages. The damages here, and I would urge the court to hearken back to yet another ruling that's not in the appendix, which is the bifurcation order that says that the judge...
I don't see how we can hearken to things that we are utterly unaware of.
Fair enough, Your Honor. Poor word choice. The order by the district court that bifurcated the case said that Mr. Kuntz could proceed with the excessive force claim, and that if he prevailed on the liability for that claim and the basic damages, he could seek damages for his detention. That's all Mr. Kuntz sought, damages for his detention. That's all that was in his motions for recovery that he raised after the trial. That's all that's been before the court, and there's absolutely no evidence in the record that the confession caused his detention. This business about emotional trauma from the Gerstein hearing, I'm not sure that that's available unless he has evidence of it. He doesn't point to any evidence of it.
We may not be there yet since he got cut off at the pass. But, right.
But our position on this case is that he was beaten, he was injured, and he recovered for that injury. He's seeking enhanced damages, but he has no proof to take to a jury. The only evidence that he has will just confuse the jury about the elements of the crime that supposedly required the confession to establish scienter, its element, when Illinois law says that it does not require anything of the kind, that his own account of what happened was sufficient to convict him. In fact, in the People v. Wallace case that we cite, similar evidence was overwhelmingly sufficient to convict him. So
but he couldn't have been convicted if a jury in a hypothetical criminal trial had found that he didn't know any, had no idea that the car was stolen. You know, I borrow a car from my brother, and, you know, I drive it over to the grocery store, and I get stopped by the police, and I discover to my great chagrin later on that my brother stole it. I'm not going around assuming that cars I borrow are stolen.
Agreed, Your Honor, but that's not the evidence that was in this case. The evidence that was in this
case
was flooded.
But he would have introduced evidence at such a trial saying he didn't know it was stolen. We know that.
There's no evidence in the record that he could. His own account of what happened in the trial on the excessive force claim, as we lay out in our briefs, under the Gentry case, which was adopted by the Illinois Supreme Court.
Look, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I mean, it seems to me clear from all of his briefs that he contests his knowledge that this was a stolen vehicle. He's at the bar, and Nick or somebody, you know.
Oh, right. Somebody named Eric loaned him the car.
Whoever, Eric.
Very similar to the facts in Wallace.
I know, but you're saying that the only way the jury could have come out is to convict. And I'm just saying if there's a jury issue, there's a jury issue. They might convict, they might acquit.
With respect, Your Honor, I'm not talking about the jury in the criminal case. I'm talking about about the jury in a case that would try his 1983 case. And the question is not whether he would have been convicted for this crime, but whether there was enough evidence to proceed with the charge. No reasonable state's attorney would look at Wallace and Gentry, the arrest report in this case, and say, oh, I can't proceed with this case because I don't have enough evidence. It's sufficient evidence as a matter of law, overwhelming evidence as a matter of Illinois law, that that assistant state's attorney would have been applying. There's no possibility that he can prove.
Your position.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further, Mr. Lovey?
I want to address just a few points. Counsel just represented that our only evidence is the expert, and that is not true. Nasser, DeFelice's partner, said they don't do it unless you got a confession if you got the keys. You have DeFelice himself. Why would DeFelice beat an allegedly superfluous confession out of somebody unless they needed proof that he knew it was stolen? A jury could infer that you don't, if a confession is superfluous, why is he in there punching him until he confesses it's stolen? The expert is the best piece of evidence. He says, I worked there, I've done 1,000 cases in that court, and they aren't going with it if you got the keys and there's no steering wheel peeled unless you got a confession. And the district court did not say that the expert was not qualified to say that. In fact, the district court said the opposite.
I don't understand why that is helpful. You suppose the prosecutor concedes that since there are so many crimes that I turn back, I take cases only when there's a 99% chance of conviction. But showing that, and showing that therefore the prosecutor would not take a case where there's only a 90% chance of conviction, doesn't imply that it's a malicious prosecution if he takes it.
But what the district court, what the expert was saying was, as a matter of practice, in that building.
As a matter of practice, the prosecutor takes cases only when there's overwhelmingly likely to convict. But showing that that standard wasn't met is a very large gap from what I understand the state rule on malicious prosecution to be.
Well, it's not that only when they think they can win, it's they won't do it unless they have a confession under those circumstances.
Fine, but I don't understand why that has anything to do with state law of malicious prosecution. Right? It's just the prosecutor has the internal standard is, in order to be sure that I've got a slam dunk, I want a confession. But that doesn't mean that if you've not got that, then you must have malicious prosecution.
I think the answer to that is probable cause is a quintessential fact question, and under the cases cited by my opponent, a jury could infer the probable cause based on the flight. But those cases don't say that the jury has to infer. And they'll present their side to the jury, we'll present our side to the jury, and the jury will decide if there was or was not probable cause based on the fact that that he fled. Because there are other reasons you could flee. You could flee because you have drugs on your possession. You could flee because you did a hit and run. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.